This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to the podcast of The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9.
Petri Dish, noun. A small, shallow dish of thin glass or plastic with a loose cover used especially for cultures in bacteriology. Petrie was an assistant to the eminent bacteriologist Robert Koch. In 1887, Petrie introduced a vessel for growing bacteria that consisted of two round rim plates, one serving as a cover for the other, Petri dish.
You're listening to the Petri Dish here on Joy 94.9, and thanks to the lovely boys from Generation Next, Marco and Petro, going over time, but that's okay.
They did a great job.
They did. So what are we talking about tonight, Wendy?
Today we're going to be talking about addiction and taking you through exactly what it is when your brain becomes addicted to something.
Yes, we're going to ask the question, does it only take once to get addicted? Is that really a myth or is it fact?
That's right. Our science controversy today is gambling, and can you really be addicted to gambling?
And we'll also be reminding you about the effects of caffeine, the good and the bad. And also, instead of doing science fiction, we went on a character from Sesame Street, because we interview Sesame Street every week.
That's right. And today we're asking, can the Cookie Monster be addicted to cookies?
Yes. Does it really? Is he really? Can it really happen?
You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9, and today we're talking about addiction, and Shane is going to explain to us exactly what is addiction.
Yeah, so you may be all thinking, what is addiction? And it is actually a really important part of the way humans function. That is very surprising. Yes, you'd be like, but wait, isn't addiction associated with drugs? No, it's not.
Take me through this.
So addiction works through something like commonly referred to as a reward/stress response system within our brains. Yeah.
Okay.
It involves this little almond-shaped part of the brain located near your brain stem called the amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
And the amygdala is sensitive to emotions because it's so close to the blood vessels that it reacts a lot to hormones and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so because we get, like, when our heart rate increases when we're excited, and then it's going to activate the amygdala
more.
Yeah,
so the amygdala is really sensitive, so it's really responsible for our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then we have a second thing called the nucleus accumbens. Nucleus accumbens, has everyone got that? And it's our mood response to thoughts or stimulus. So, for example, if I hear a fire truck going,
mm-hmm.
that will stimulate me to think, oh my God, there's fire somewhere, danger. So I should flee and look out for it. And, you know, where is it coming from? That's the response you have. Is that right?
Right. This is my understanding. That's right. And when you hear that siren, then so your heart rate's going to go up and the amygdala is also going to have a response.
Yeah, exactly. And so these two parts are very closely associated, as you just pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they associate with good and bad responses. So things are good and bad. So we learn from them. So it's a real vital thing for us to survive, actually.
All right. So one day we might eat a berry or something that we didn't like in a evolutionary sense.
Yeah.
And we might have a really bad response to that berry.
Yeah. And you'll kind of remember that you shouldn't eat it again.
Okay. Great.
It won't be a good effect. But if it was a berry that we did like, say it was this really yummy berry, it will release a neurotransmitter. So, special neurotransmitters will release dopamine.
So, what's a neurotransmitter?
A neurotransmitter are they're little chemical messages that are sent between your neurons. So, they're the messages. So, they're little envelopes with messages in them. And when you get it, it's like, hello, this is what you should do now.
Ah, so they let your neurons communicate with each other.
Yes, exactly. Basically, yeah.
Excellent.
And so, they release a hormone called dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And dopamine makes us feel happy. It gives that jolt of happiness, that excitement.
Right.
Excellent. So when we're feeling happy and like euphoric, it's dopamine. It's all to do with dopamine.
So you eat a berry, dopamine kicks in.
Yeah.
The areas of your brain that need to be activate, and remember, this is great berry, do it again.
Yeah. And so when you see the berry, you want to eat it again because it's also good for you. So it's also when you're eating food and stuff, it's really important. And things like reproduction, that's why sex feels good, is because you need to have sex to reproduce to ensure your survival. So that's why it feels good.
Right.
And you want to keep doing it.
So how does this fit into addiction?
So addiction's the same thing. So for example, if I had a drug, such as heroin, which acts like dopamine. It's continually giving me that happy drive.
Mm.
And so that happy feeling and that, oh, I really need it, makes your brain think that you need it to survive, and it brings your body back to, it makes it as if it's homeostatic, so the normal state of the body makes it think that's normal.
That much dopamine or that much heroin
yep.
is normal.
Yeah.
Right.
And like another example is cocaine, which blocks the reabsorption of dopamine because sometimes too much dopamine is released, and that's usually taken up by the cell that sent the dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
But drugs like cocaine inhibit that, and so therefore you have dopamine floating around in your system, and you're, oh yeah, this is really good and happy, and so you keep on, it's, you think it's a good thing, and that's how you start getting addicted.
Right.
And as time goes on, the less sensitive your cells, your neurons become to dopamine, and so therefore the stronger concentrations of those drugs you'll need to have that same effect.
So kind of like when you're swimming in a pool and it starts off and it's really cold when you jump in. So that's sort of like your neurons originally being exposed to dopamine and they're really excited. And then if they're exposed to that all the time, like if you're in that swimming pool all the time, you're going to get used to that water.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're going to need that temperature to drop. In order to feel that it's cold. And so, like, these neurons are going to need more dopamine, like that change in temperature. They're going to need it to start having.
And then addiction, like substance abuse and addiction. And if you keep on going, like, continuing, it can also lead to neurological disorders such as Parkinson's disease due to lack of dopamine production because it's overstimulating the production of dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
Or your receptors aren't, like, they don't respond anymore to the uptake of too much dopamine. Like, so you destroy your brainstem where it all happens.
Right. So, this is the science of addiction.
Yes, this is the science of addiction.
So, what are some things that can get us addicted? I know we're going to talk about gambling later in the show and cookies.
We're going to have gambling, cookies, caffeine, sugar, a lot of things we ingest. Also, like, visual pleasures such as, you know, like, porn. Like, you know, that also has a effect of dopamine because it's a sex response. So, addiction to porn is also linked to this as well.
And so, what do you think is the difference between a habit versus addiction? And can you really get addicted to porn? Is it anything that we get an enjoyment out of is going to release enough dopamine in the body for us to then claim that this is an addiction? And
well, I think a habit can turn into an addiction because, you know, you need, like, for example, let's use our good old Facebook. You know, we now come to the age of, like, people addicted to Facebook. We had a, like, stress management teacher come into my class talking about the dangers of Facebook because it begins the habit checking it every day. It's like, why do you need to check it every day? Because you're communicating with your friends, and I guess it makes you feel happy, and, you know, seeing these photos make you feel happy. So you probably are getting addicted to all these visual images.
I have a theory. We're addicted to the word addicted. I don't think you can actually say you're addicted to Facebook or addicted to checking your phone,
really?
Addicted to lip balm.
Well, what's your definition?
I think if we're going on this dopamine theory, you would need enough dopamine produced. When you talk about substance abuse, like cocaine and heroin, that is a lot of dopamine being released into your brain. So we might get a little bit of enjoyment out of checking our Facebook and getting an email. There's not going to be that much to get you addicted to the same extent. And I think that by saying I'm addicted, all of a sudden it's okay. And not only that, but all of a sudden we need to have a therapy or a drug that can then stop you getting addicted.
Well, maybe we should talk about maybe the signs of how you know you're addicted. Let's ask yourself this. Do you feel that you, like, after 24 hours without the substance, do you feel really moody and are you shaking? So, for example, Facebook, do you feel shaky?
Not at all, but I wouldn't even pretend to be considered to fake.
Or would you do anything to get to it as well? That's another sign of addiction.
So, these are signs of general addiction.
Yeah, would you do anything to get of it? You have volatile mood swings, you won't be sleeping properly if you don't get it, sweating, obviously irrational behaviour, because we're not feeling normal, and that's what addiction's about. You're addicted because you need it to feel normal.
Right. Yeah. So I suppose some people would have those reactions if that's how we're going to define addiction.
Yeah, and, you know, addiction is also recently being found to be a genetic link as well. They have found about 6 genes, which is associated with it, and the combination of these 6 genes are linked to different types of addiction. And this actually hasn't been published yet, but thanks to our producer, Mr. Kane Day, got this source from Nature Review of Genetics from April 2009. So he's gone into the future and brought back this article for us.
Excellent. Yes. And this says that, so there's a genetic link. Now, so these genes that are mostly associated with dopamine in the brain, dopamine production and dopamine receptors.
Well, we don't have the full details of the article, but when it comes out, we'll definitely discuss it.
Update.
Yeah, we have an update on those genes.
So that's the science of addiction. And next, we're going to talk about the myth that it only takes once to get addicted.
We got two emails in, one from the lovely Danbo, who's sick at the moment, so we hope you get better soon. And he emails us, Cookie Monster, me eat cookie, om nom 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 nom.
Okay, I think the only reason he sent that was so that we would then go, om nom 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 nom.
Yeah, I know, I fell into the trap. And one from Adam, who says, addiction, here is my hero of addiction, yay. And it's a picture of a guy from, I think, the Big Kahuna. Don't really know who he is.
That's right, but I guess according to Adam, that picture is releasing enough dopamine for him to get him so excited.
And if you have anything to send us, email us on onair@joy.org.au or SMS us on 0427JOY949 about anything we're talking about tonight.
Just any questions or any ideas for future topics. But for the moment, Shane is going to tell us about the myth that it only takes once to get addicted. Is that true? This is a curiosity of mine.
Well, what do you think? Is it true? Do you think you can only get addicted by doing it once?
No, I don't think so. I think what it is that you do it once and you like the experience. So you do it again and you do it again and then maybe...
But don't you think that you wanting to do it again is an addiction?
No, I think just because you've enjoyed something and want to do it again does not make it an addiction. I think we need a higher threshold of what is an addiction.
I think Wendy may have several addictions, but we won't go through that. Yeah. Well, according to Dr. Richard Hunt from the Nicotine Dependency Unit at the Mayo Clinic in the United States, so it's a little bit of a bias study because he's from the Nicotine Dependency Unit at the Mayo Clinic in the United States. He says, yes, you can get addicted from just once.
Yeah, bias.
Bias. It is a little bit bias. And this research was reported in the British Medical Association Journal, Tobacco Control. So, another, it's still a biased thing. Let's just put it out there. It's a bit biased.
That's right. So, these guys don't want you smoking, not once, not ever.
But they followed 681 teenagers aged 12 and 13 from 7 different schools in central Massachusetts for a year and tracked their smoking habits.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, after their first smoke, the things they felt when they did not have it, they started having cravings for it. They wanted to have more smoke to get the same buzz. They actually started suffering withdrawal symptoms from when not smoking.
Even after really one cigarette. How many? What percentage?
Just one. 63%.
Had withdrawal symptoms. I think they got a certain buzz from smoking and just wanted it again. I don't think that's a withdrawal symptom. It's like if you watch a TV show and you enjoy it and you look forward to it tomorrow, that is not an addiction.
That's not an addiction?
Although, obviously, smoking does cause an addiction after enough times.
Yeah, well...
But convince me. What else have we got?
Sorry, that's one article I found. Because most...
One article.
Yes, I'm a bad scientist this week.
Written by a biased source.
But having said that... Right? We get addicted to food. It's just part of our natural response. So, I have an inkling to say that you can just have once. Because your body's going to think that this is for your survival. It's making you feel good. I think you just need it. You need just the one time just getting addicted.
You think your body's that silly? That it thinks everything is for your survival?
I think your body could be that silly. Yes, you have a conscience and that's a totally different topic, but on the base rate, yes, I think your body could be really that silly. Like, we keep craving... And people who just have the one hit, right, and go, oh, I want to try it again because I enjoyed it. I'm going to be an occasional smoker because I crave it, and they associate it with it. That's a kind of addiction, and they just start, and they just keep justifying it to themselves.
No, I think the addiction has to take hold when you stop being able to consciously control yourself. Or when it becomes incredibly hard. Perhaps I retake my view. It has to become incredibly hard to stop it. And after having one cigarette, whilst you might want it, or after watching a TV show, you might want to watch it again. That is not an addiction.
That's not an addiction. You don't think that's an addiction, wanting to, you looking out for it. Like, I have friends who purposely, after they have one cigarette... And they only say, I have it with a drink. They purposely go out, have a drink, and so they can smoke. They buy smokes for the night because they know they're going to smoke.
Well, that's right. But these people have smoked before.
Yes, they have smoked before.
Maybe many times before.
Just the one time before, I have friends who I've seen smoke the one time, and they they associated that and like, oh, that's a good buzz. I'm going to do it again. And they use it as an excuse. And I think that's an addiction, the beginning of an addiction. And they're all now smokers.
Well, in this case, it was the beginning of an addiction because they're now all smokers. But this is clearly anecdotal evidence. You can stick that where it fits. And I'm telling you, it doesn't fit on the Petri dish.
I think it does. I think it's a legitimate. I think it can. Just one time can get you addicted. And as we said, there are people more susceptible through genetics, like family history of alcoholism and things like that. It does a little bit more, but yeah.
It takes less to get it. I agree with that. That there's certain people with addictive disorder, with addictive personalities, and they might be susceptible. However, I'm still not convinced. I think this is still a myth that it only takes once to get
addicted. You still think it's a myth?
Addicted. But I do see the power in people not wanting to try it once because they're afraid that they might enjoy it. And if they do, then they'll feel like they're missing out on something.
So the seeking of it after enjoying it the first time, you don't think that's an addiction?
No.
You don't think that's an addiction? The needing of it because you want to feel that high.
I think you're getting addicted to wanting me to change my mind.
Yes, I am addicted to getting you to change your mind.
And your withdrawal symptoms are going to be stubbornness and repetitiveness. So perhaps before we continue this on, if you would like to SMS and say whether you agree with this, that you can get addicted after just one time, please do so on 0427JOY949. And our next topic is going to be whether you can get addicted to gambling. And this is one that I don't think you can after one go at gambling, even though you might enjoy it. But I will...
I think you can get... Oh, I don't know. You could get addicted from one time if you keep with you one big. Then again, if you win big, you don't need to come back there.
Well, we're going to be discussing this all after this song. Radio.
Ever wanted to learn the ins and outs of radio broadcasting?
Through Joy 94.9's A Taste of Radio short course, you'll learn on-air presentation, media law, digital editing, interviewing, panel operation and much more.
Classes run for one evening per week for 8 weeks.
To register your interest or for more information, email courses@joy.org.au. courses@joy.org.au.
You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9 and we've had a few SMSs in.
Yes, we have. We're very excited.
We were. Nick, I was especially excited about your SMS, which said that Wendy is on the money, addiction takes time. So, was not convinced by Shane.
Okay, I did take a long time to find that one article.
That's true,
I just wanted to be controversial, okay?
Which makes me believe even more. That's right. If there's no studies really proving that addiction happens once, probably doesn't.
And we got another SMS from Lonnie saying, she's a fan, love the show. I have a topic for you. Water everywhere, but what is the best type to drink? Tap, mineral, spring or rain?
So next week we're talking about stem cells and controversies about that. But the week after, we're going to be answering Lonnie's question about what water is the best type of water to drink. And there's a lot of water myths out there. Is tap water actually dangerous? Do you need to let it run a little bit?
Do we really need 8 cups a day?
Do we really need 8 glasses of water a day? Exactly. And I've got my own theories on that one. But for the moment, we're talking about addiction today. And right now, I'm going to be talking about addiction to gambling. Can you really have an addiction to gambling? And this is a bit of an interesting one because most of the things that Shane was talking about was having an addiction to something that you eat or drugs. So you're putting something in your body and it's having a direct effect on your brain. And that seems like it's pretty easier. It's easier for us to understand exactly because your blood is kind of breaking down what you've just ingested and then it goes straight to your brain. But with an addiction to a behavior like Facebook or like gambling, it's a lot more difficult to study and a lot more difficult to prove that it's actually happening. Yeah. Because you gamble and exactly how your brain is changing will change from person to person. And recently, only in the last 15 years, have they actually thought of gambling as a disorder. And it's an impulsive disorder that's classed along with pyromania and kleptomania and also dermatillomania. A lot of manias.
What's dermatillomania?
This is a disorder where you are constantly scratching yourself.
Oh, okay.
And it's a little bit associated with when you've got, we all know when you've got a scab, you just want to pick it.
Yeah.
But these people who are sufferers take that a little bit too far and it can cause trouble. And so these are disorders that are all based on being impulsive. And when we talk about being addicted to gambling, this is what they're considered with. Now, just like the dopamine that we were talking about, that when you get addicted to something, you get a release of dopamine. When people gamble, they get an enjoyment out of it, or some people get an enjoyment out of it, and it does release dopamine. Now, there's studies that also show that if you have a recent study that actually just came out last week, was that near misses will release almost the same amount of dopamine as actually winning on the pokies.
So, is it kind of like when you... Is gambling addiction maybe the same as, like, getting addicted to video games? You know, when you have that, even though you've lost, you keep trying because this is the thrill, that dopamine, is that the same thing maybe?
I think it is related, but there's more on the line with gambling. So gambling, the definition of it, is where you're putting something on the line that you could win or lose in order to get something bigger. And the more that's on the line, the more that your brain is going to be at a state of heightened alert. And so when you were talking about the amygdala and your heart racing, your body's really primed to actually have an addiction because it's in this high state of stress. But having said that, whether you can have an addiction to it in the same way that you can have an addiction to drug is a really controversial issue. But this near-miss study was actually pretty interesting because it showed that with people who were not pathological gamblers, which is the term that they use for people, quote, addicted to gambling. It's a pathological gambler. But with healthy volunteers, that tone of voice was a quote.
Healthy volunteers. Yes.
They showed them playing the slot machine, and if you were close to winning, enough dopamine was released as if you won. And so this explains why if you get a near miss, you're more likely to keep playing. And it also explains why pokey machines might be rigged in order to have more near misses so that you do keep playing and you do getting this enjoyment. And they found that people in this study who released more dopamine than others during these near miss situations were more likely in a survey that they made them do after, they were more likely to agree to phrases that pathological gamblers agree to. Phrases like, I've played for a long time and lost, so my win will be coming.
Ooh.
So there's people like we were talking about being prone to certain, being prone to having an addiction. People who are releasing more dopamine, they're getting more enjoyment out of the gambling experience.
Than
someone who's less prone.
Okay, yep.
And they're having a neurological reaction similar to pathological gamblers.
So is your conclusion that gambling is an addiction or a habit? Because we actually haven't defined that line between a habit and addiction yet.
No, and I think it's a very hard line to put, and I think the only reason that it would matter is that if it makes people feel like they can't break something the moment they call it an addiction, whereas we feel like we can break habits. And so if it's a personal... It's a personal issue. In that case, nothing should be called an addiction.
However, but we can break addictions as well. This is going to say that, you know, like, for example, Jenny here, who, you know, was in before, saying she's been off chocolate for a week. She's finding it really hard as well. Like, is that the same thing? Is eating chocolate a habit?
Well, perhaps we'll talk about that in just a second. I'll get a little more.
Okay.
A little
tell
more
us,
on
tell
this
us
gambling.
More about gambling.
Well, I think on this idea of breaking the habit and whether you can is drug treatment. So I think a huge part of once you claim something's an addiction, you try and it's a disease then that you can try and make a drug to. And the moment that you can give someone a drug to stop the addiction is the moment that we really do say this is a disorder and now we found the cause of it because we found the solution. There's this drug you can take and it's a solution. And with gambling, there are certain drugs related to dopamine. So it either prevents the release of dopamine in your brain, or it will make dopamine not have such an effect on your brain. So for dopamine, as Shane was talking about, if you've just tuned in, dopamine's released when we have Beautiful. When we have a joyful experience, we release dopamine. And these drugs will either not allow dopamine to have an effect on the brain, so that for dopamine to have an effect, you have a receptor in your brain that sort of grabs the dopamine and it will block these receptors. And they found that when people do take these drugs, they will, it will be easier for them to break the habit of gambling.
Because they're not getting the kick out of it.
That they once were, that's right. But it's not so clear cut, and these drugs are not so successful, which tells us there's more to gambling
than just the
dopamine.
Dopamine. Obviously, because, you know, there's a thrill of the win, and there's the visual, like, you know, a lot of theories about, you know, the pretty lights make you forget time and all these things. Like, casinos are designed to make you feel like you're in a vortex of time. Which I don't necessarily believe, because I go into the casino and walk immediately out because I can't stand the lights.
No, me neither. But I suppose once you got used to them, and once you became addicted to the lights, then your brain would think that that was normal to have so many lights.
So I guess maybe, you know, gambling is a homeostatic, like, you know, it's homeostasis for them, the bright lights and stuff. The environment becomes normal to them. Maybe going to the casino makes them feel normal, not made to the gambling environment. Ooh.
I wonder.
Another layer. But we got a... This is from Lonnie. Who is a guy? I'm sorry if I said you're a girl.
Oh, I'm sorry too.
And it's an addiction born from habit. And I think... Do you think that can happen?
I think that could be true.
I think that could be true. Like, with my anecdote before, that started off as a habit, so to speak, where, you know, they started smoking while they were drinking, and that it developed into an addiction of smoking every day.
That's right. I think that you start off enjoying something, or perhaps you don't even enjoy it, but you feel like you should because the people around you are kind of enjoying it or pretending to enjoy it.
Can I rephrase my myth then? That, you know, we can have... It takes one to develop a habit, maybe, because you want to keep going and trying? No, that's not a habit.
I don't know, but I think me and Lonnie have won. I think you've decided that you cannot get addicted after one.
Thanks, guys.
The theories are looking like gambling definitely has an effect on the brain. Whether you want to call it an addiction or not is still a question. Mm. Right now, it's not defined as an addiction, because if it's compared to pyromania, I don't think that anyone's trying to say that pyromaniacs are addicted to fire.
No, it's just a disorder. They get off of lighting fire. So anyway, that's a different topic about pyromanias. And
excellent.
I got a question. Did you find about, like, the visuals and the oral cues they hear from gambling affecting them? Like the sound of gambling, does that release a dopamine? Like the sound of the machine going, the clinking?
I actually didn't find any studies about the whole casino environment. It was mainly just the win and the loss and putting money on the line in preparation to lose it. But I definitely think that that would have a huge part of the psychology of enjoying the gambling. I did hear this, that this is anecdotal evidence, not from my grandma, yes. But that oldies like the pokey machines where they actually pull down the slots.
Yeah.
And so when a lot of casinos were bumping up their technology just to make it a button, so some pokey machines are just buttons, and they would actually lose business because oldies like to pull the slots. So that's why you've got an actual slot machine.
What's this new dandangled technology?
That's right. What's with this present buttons?
Well, is that it? Is that the conclusion? Gambling is an addiction?
Oh,
or it's a complex situation.
It's a complex situation.
All right. And if you have anything to say to us, like Lonnie, you can SMS us on 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au. And quickly, Chris and Ben from Channel 10 say hello as well.
Oh, thank you.
They're saying they're loving the show. That's great. You're listening to Joy949 with a Petri Dish. And we've been talking about addiction, and hopefully you are addicted or have a habit of listening to our show at 10 p.m. on Tuesday nights now.
That's right. And this is a habit you should not try to break.
No, don't break this habit. And, you know, if you have any suggestions for the show, be sure to SMS in on 0427JOY949 or email onair@joy.org.au. Especially if you have any questions about what we're talking about and you kind of lost.
That's right. Now, this segment of the show is what we like to call Remember This Scientific Fact. And this is something that you might have learned in primary school or in high school, or something that someone keeps telling you but you've probably forgotten, or maybe you know. And today, keeping with the theme of addiction, we're talking about how caffeine works in your body.
Yeah,
so Shane's going to take us through that.
This caffeine is a molecule, it's a drug.
Mm-hmm.
Found in naturally occurring things such as coffee beans, cocoa beans, tea leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So they also, tea does have coffee in it. So you think tea is better than coffee? Not really true, because it still has caffeine in it. and caffeine takes about 5 to 30 minutes to circulate in your body after you drink it, and the effects of caffeine last about 12 hours, or until it runs out.
12 hours?
Yeah, it can last, but obviously as time goes on, the effect of caffeine wears away, like as hours go on, but it's still in your bloodstream.
I'm currently drinking tea. I'm never going to sleep tonight.
Yeah, well, tea is different because it also has other chemicals and properties.
All right, so
we'll steer clear of that at the moment.
Excellent. So you drink a cup of coffee, and what's going on with this drug?
So this drug, like as we know, it stimulates us. It increases, again, increase our metabolic rate. It makes us feel a bit more alert, concentration. Studies have shown that you have a better short-term memory as well. Because you're concentrating a bit more in the short term, long term is a bit different. But the short term of having caffeine, like immediately, like after, makes you really focused and concentrated.
So how does it do that? Why does it make you focused, and why does it increase your metabolic?
Okay, so there's another molecule in your body called adenosine, which is a molecule that is, like, from research, from reading, is to calm your body down. It naturally calms your body down. So caffeine and adenosine are actually two molecules which have similar structures. So where adenosine binds in your body, caffeine more readily binds to that more easily. Does that make sense?
It sure does. So caffeine is almost like the evil twin, or yes, the good twin, the interesting twin to the boring old adenosine.
Yeah, so it blocks adenosine from binding, and so you're in this constant state of, whoa, yeah, let's go, let's get excited. And, you know, it's a type of rush as well.
So caffeine actually isn't doing anything itself. It's just stopping adenosine from acting, and that's how it works.
That is what research is saying, that is what is happening. It's actually nothing to do with caffeine. The molecule itself is not doing anything. It's not like absorbed into your bloodstream and it has these magical powers. It's actually just blocking another molecule from doing its job.
Right, and so what exactly will happen once adenosine can't work?
Well, you start becoming, you know, as I said, excited. You become more alert and energetic. You also blocks another molecule, the antidiuretic hormone. So you pee more because your water uptake isn't as good anymore. So you're peeing more and you're peeing out. So if you ever notice, if you drink 3 cups of coffee, you're constantly going to the toilet. That is why. Now, you can get addicted to coffee, because it does give you that rush. It does make you happy. And, you know addiction, because, like, I had that addiction to coffee, and to the point where I didn't have it 24 hours. I had a massive migraine and headache, and that's one of the big signs of you have a coffee addiction.
Right. And so why are you having a headache? Is that dehydration?
It's because your body is not in this normal state anymore, because that's the addiction point. As we talked about it before, your body finds it not normal, so it's telling you that you need to take it, and you start searching for and craving it. Right. And, if you don't have it, you sweat more and you're profuse and you're like, oh, my God, I need coffee. Like, you do notice that after, if you don't have coffee, sometimes you shake a lot as well.
Yeah.
That's another reason. So, those are signs of addiction as well. So, coffee, even though, that's the bad side of coffee. But also, researching this, came across everything interesting about caffeine protecting the brain.
It protects the brain?
Yeah. So, it's a study to do with Alzheimer's disease. And caffeine actually strengthens, like, your brain has this blood barrier, which protects things getting into your brain to affecting it. And things like cholesterol weakens it. And caffeine actually strengthens this barrier and decreases the chance of cholesterol binding to this and, invading your brain.
Whoa, slow down. So, why do we need a barrier between our brain?
To prevent, viral particles and bacteria from entering our brain, causing disease. So, our brain is highly protected.
Well, that's pretty clever. And so cholesterol actually breaks down that barrier.
Yes, it has a negative effect on it. So
whereas coffee will improve the barrier. So if I have a cake and a coffee with my cake, gold. Is that what you're telling me?
Maybe not that simple. It's still in its early stages of research. But, yes, coffee is good. I don't know about the cake part with cholesterol, and I don't know what kind of fats
you're
having.
What if it's a coffee-flavoured cake?
Ooh, win. Let's send that to the researchers in the UK. So, coffee is not all that bad for you. And, it also has, sometimes I think a fair word, antioxidant.
It does indeed. And it's also an aphrodisiac, I've heard, coffee.
Oh, I didn't research that far into aphrodisiac. Didn't come across it, so it might be true.
But it could just be to do with being more alert and
more alert and
blood's rushing around the body, all parts of the body.
Yeah, because you're feeling a bit more active. And, and as we energy drinks have, a lots amount of caffeine in it, and we tend to feel really lethargic and tired the next day. It's because we've worn out our body and we've overworked our neurons and parts of our body. So, therefore, we feel really tired the next day.
Right. And is that going to be the possible beginnings of an addiction? Because then you get really tired your body just needs to relax. But if you need to be awake, you might have more coffee, more caffeine.
And that's probably the beginning of an addiction / habit. And also, and you know, you can coffee can be lethal, but it takes a lot of coffee for it to be lethal. You need about 80 cups of strong coffee.
And what will you die from?
It'll be an overdose of coffee. So, it'll be the same effect as a drug. Like, you become overstimulated and your body works too much and your brain will shut down. And it's pretty serious. Like, it's really rare to happen, but it can happen.
Is that anecdotal that someone has actually died from a...
Yeah, this is from a recent... I think this is a one-off case. It's a very rare case. It's a very rare case. And in kids...
Is it Italy? Is someone in Italy?
They didn't say.
We love stereotypes. But
it also says that, you know, kids, some kids, it only takes 2 cups of coffee. So that's only 1 gram of caffeine for them to go to have a drug overdose in little kids. That's why you should not give kids coffee when they're younger.
Wait, slow down. So you need 80 cups for
an adult
and 2 cups for a little kid.
Yeah, because caffeine also, the way caffeine affects your body is also dependent on your body, your weight, your age, your gender. It has all these other effects of how caffeine affects your body.
Right.
Yeah, there Excellent. We go.
And just for a little tidbit that I've got to add to that, which is a great explanation of caffeine, is that dark chocolate actually, now when you have caffeine, it contracts your blood vessels, and that's part of how it works to increase your heart rate. Well, it stops adenosine, which expands your blood vessels, but the effect is that so your blood vessels tighten, so blood rushes through your body faster, and having dark chocolate will expand your blood vessels. And so if you don't like the effect of sometimes it really, especially in your neck, if you've had a lot of caffeine, you can feel that heart pumping, then have some dark chocolate with it.
Really? It can't do the opposite effect. But don't have coffee with the dark chocolate because that's just silly, right? Because will caffeine win?
No, that's how it's supposed to be. That,
really?
So if you have it, then you'll still have some effects of caffeine, but it will be...
Because the dark chocolate is inhibiting some of the caffeine.
That's right.
Oh.
Plus, great combo.
Where'd you get that information from, Wendy?
I actually got that from Dr. Carl.
Oh, good old Dr. Carl. You're listening to Joy 94.9 with the Petri Dish. And we're going to talk about Cookie Monster.
We sure are. Today on the show, we've been talking about addiction. And now we're going to say... Ask the question, can you get addicted to cookies? Just like Cookie Monster.
Yes, and, you know, we talk about a movie, and we usually talk about, you know, this kind of classifies. It's not really sci-fi.
But that's right. Well, I guess we'll find out, is it science fiction?
It's Cookie Monster. Can we have someone that's purely addicted to cookies and only cookies?
That's right. And research is saying, well, probably not addicted to cookies and only cookies, but you can be addicted to sugars in the same way that you can be addicted to drugs. Now, unlike drugs, they have a huge effect on the brain and the hormones released in the brain. Now, when you eat sugar, it's a lot more subtle, which means it's going to take a lot longer to develop this addiction / habit that we've liked to call it. But when you eat a cookie... Just like Shane was talking about at the beginning of the show, the amygdala, which is a certain part of the brain, will record that there's sugar, that you've just eaten sugar. And another part of the brain, which is at the front of the brain, will remember that it's a cookie and cookie equals sugar.
Yeah.
So you'll start to have this really positive association with cookie and sugar that we all have pretty much.
So that the sugar releases dopamine as well?
The sugar will release the dopamine. Dopamine's the big one on the addiction on the addiction card. It will also release insulin. As you know, when we eat sugar, insulin's a big media draw card because of diabetes and its effects on diabetes. So we'll eat the sugar, we get this insulin spike. And Kane, who is our producer and did the research for this section, believes that it's actually the insulin spike that is causing the addiction and the effect of insulin on your brain, and that the insulin, when we eat a lot of sugar and all this insulin's released, that's our threshold for what's normal, and what's a normal level of insulin in our blood actually increases. So then we start to need more and more cookies, hence the Cookie Monster wanting more and more cookies.
I'm gonna just say a little thing about the brain and glucose, is that the brain glucose receptors have a really low point, like they don't need that much insulin for it to uptake. It's always uptaking, so it's always super saturated. Does that make sense to you?
that the glucose... So, can you explain what glucose does in relation
to... So, glucose gives us energy and it breaks down for our basic metabolic processes. And we have receptors in our blood cells, so our red blood cells that carry these things, that which insulin promotes it to uptake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certain, like, there's... I don't really remember it because, you know, long time ago for me, these glucose receptors. But there's also different saturations and different types of glucose receptors that react to certain concentrations of glucose. And so your brain, so it's always working, has a very low point where it always need glucose, so it always metabolizing it. Does that make sense to you?
Makes a little bit of sense. But pretty much the brain needs glucose to always be functioning.
Yeah, so insulin doesn't have that much of effect on the brain because it's really constantly uptaking it because you're always using it.
Right. So, perhaps on that level, you actually can't get addicted to cookies via insulin. Maybe it is more of a habit. You just enjoy the cookies.
The texture, the flavour. Because you remember when we talked about tasting, you know, we taste with our, you know, the taste buds. Or, this is really good. And, you know, our dopamine being released at the one time. You know, I do really Cookie Monster can get addicted. And he probably has diabetes as well.
Well, that's right. Well, that was another thing that we were thinking, that after 40 years... Kane tells me 40 years this year of Sesame Street, of eating all these cookies, Cookie Monster's probably got diabetes. Not so associated with whether he's addicted, but an interesting and very sad thing to think about as well.
Yeah, type 2 diabetes as well.
Now, Kane was also noting that Cookie Monster, he estimated his age to be 3 to 5. I like that he's estimating the age of a Cookie Monster, but it's probably pretty safe to say, considering his vocabulary consists of cookie, cookie, cookie.
Yeah.
And I think just from me saying that, you can tell I don't know a lot of 3 to 5 year olds.
Yeah. Emma was addicted to pizza. Did anyone know that? He always asked for pizza and they had to make him stop saying that as well.
Who's that?
Elmo.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Anyway, but the point that I was about to make...
Sorry.
Was that when you're at this age, you actually don't have the capacity to think about the future consequences of a lot of your actions. So, you want that cookie now. So, studies that tell kids, well, if you hold out and don't eat this cookie now, you'll get 2 later. And that sort of debate in your brain that says, if I hold out now, I'll get a greater gratification later, is not something that kids can do at 3 to 5. And they also can't think of the sad or the negative sides of eating a cookie, such as the possibility of diabetes.
And I guess none of the adults are stopping him as well on that show. They're very irresponsible.
Well, that's right. Well, now they've become a little more responsible, and now he's the healthy eating monster, not the cookie monster.
Oh. But maybe monsters are different to humans. Maybe he has a different metabolism than us, and C is for cookie. That's all I want to hear.
That's right. And they really needed better marketing than healthy eating monster.
It's not C is for cookie. It's a sometimes food, kids. It's C is for cookie. It's good enough for me. No, A is for apple, B is for banana. It's not that. It's just C is for cookie. It's good enough for me. And it should always be like that.
It should. And kids should know, and parents should know to moderate without the need for Cookie Monster to dictate their lives.
However, we have determined this could happen, especially as kids don't have control. And I'm sounding like one of those old people that don't like the new Pookie machines. I do not like the new Cookie Monster. He does not go through the whole alphabet listing fruit and vegetables in his song. C is for cookie. Anyway.
Thanks for listening to the show tonight, guys.
Yes, and very appropriate sound to end on tonight.
Finish yourself.
Thank you for listening to the Petri Dish. Tonight's show is brought to you by the letter K for potassium and the number 19. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of the Petri Dish. For more information and the latest science updates, you can check out the blog or more podcasts at joy.org.au/thepetridish.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.